Hi, I'm Allison Gresick, and today's Hours for Art interview is with Sarah Selecki. She's a fiction writer who's devoted to the short story. And Sarah's originally from Sudbury, Ontario, and she now lives in Toronto. And her collection, This Cake is for the Party, was a finalist for the Giller Prize, and her work has appeared in The Walrus and Elle Canada and the Journey Prize anthology. And Sarah's been teaching mindful writing workshops since 2001, and she just launched Story is a State of Mind, which is an online self-paced program that teaches craft and process. And Sarah's motto is, your writing needs your whole heart if you want it to feel real, but damn, it also needs technique. And she created Story is a State of Mind to sharpen and support your whole brilliant writing self, your heart, mind, and skill. So I'm really pleased to be talking to Sarah today, and we'll ask her lots of questions about her own writing and the program. So Sarah, maybe let's start with your own writing life. I'm curious to know how you kind of found your feet in this vocation. What took you from beginner, amateur, to the accomplished and confident writer that you are now?
Well, I accomplished and confident are great words. I suppose I have to acknowledge a little bit of that, but you know, every time I finish anything, or more specifically, anytime I start anything, I really do feel like I go back to the beginning in many ways. And starting from scratch, I always have to battle with that feeling unaccomplished and unconfident all over again. Although it does get better, and it has changed over the years, but it really is starting from scratch is just one of the hardest things ever. So thank you for that wonderful introduction, by the way. I have always written, and I've always known it's what I've wanted to do probably since I really started writing. So I came to the vocation early on and always just went for it. I was really lucky. I had parents who told me that I could and that I should, instead of the other way around. So I was really lucky that way. And I think that's part of why I decided to stick with it when it was so hard. But the other side of it being difficult, I mean, being a challenge, struggling through it, is that I have also always felt that writing was a friend of mine. And especially when I was young and going through the angsty years of being a teenager, writing was my journals and my stories and my notebooks were the place where I felt most at home and most comfortable. So that steeled me, I think, for the years ahead when I started actually developing some technique and reading and teaching myself and learning and going on that on the whole trip of finding a mentor and beginning to publish and get published and refine my skill. I think because I had listened to the friendship I had with writing when I was younger, I think that gave me enough fodder and foundation to feel like I wasn't crazy to stick with it. However, having said that, I certainly had my moments of quitting writing, and feeling like this just wasn't going to work and this is ridiculous and why am I even doing this? And every time I've gone into a dip like that, I've been lucky enough to come back out again. The thing that has taken me out, I think, was just the pleasure of reading again, which is, you know, that cycle. The same thing that brought me into writing in the first place is always the thing that keeps bringing me back. It's just the pleasure and the joy and the enthrallment I get from seeing what can happen with a sentence. I don't know if that even answered your question.
It did, because what I'm hearing is that you began out of your, you know, young love of reading and putting your own words down, and that sort of forged an attachment with writing that carried you through some of the rockier times later as you were
exactly
trying to bring your skills up and bring your work into
exactly
the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is what happened, and it continues to happen. I think that right now I'm finding that again, where I'm just sort of searching because I've finished a couple big projects, one right after the other, and now there's this swath of like this horizon in front of me. Like, what am I going to write next? And I don't want to write the same book that I've already written. I don't want to write the same thing. So where if I start getting pulled in by the feeling that I need to publish something, or I need to write something in order to be productive, or I need to, even worse, like write something that will be critically acclaimed or win some kind of prize or something, that just takes me further and further out from the really key important part of why I am doing this, which is my relationship to the work. And my relationship to the work is fundamentally connected to my relationship to reading. So right now I'm taking a little hiatus from teaching and a hiatus from writing, and I'm just gonna read.
Oh, that sounds so delicious.
Doesn't it? I haven't quite started yet, so I'm just as excited about it as it sounds. I'm not there yet, but when that happens, it's going to be great. It's like a couple weeks from now. I just have a reading holiday, but it's not a holiday, it's work. But I'm so excited about that it feels like it's a holiday.
I like the way you talk about your whole writing self, heart, mind, and skill, and now you're also talking about these pieces of there's the writing and there's the teaching, which I think is part of that too, and then the reading and learning how to combine those to make that whole writing life. Tell me what it is about short fiction that has really captured you.
Oh, that's a great question. I didn't start out reading short stories. I don't think many people do, actually. I started out reading novels and found short fiction because I started writing it. I think that's really common. I think that I've heard short stories called the writer's the writer's writing, and the form that's written by writers for writers. And there's something to that, although I'm trying to really crack that open as much as I as one person can. I'm trying to bust that myth, although it's not really a myth, is it? But I started reading them because I knew that that's where I needed to start publishing. It's a more manageable, it starts out feeling, and it is more manageable, a place to really start honing your skill, honing your sentences, and actually getting your work out there. And in Canada, at least, the granting system works more functionally for writers who have little pieces published along the way. So I was, I've been working in various patchwork career jobs here and there, always taking time off or quitting because I needed to write and never really wanting a full career. But because of that, I needed some other funding, and Canada's been wonderful that way. I mean, touch wood so far. And what you need in order to apply for a grant is, four short stories published on your CV. So that was my first goal, was getting four short stories published. Well, in order to figure out how to write short stories, I just had to learn how to read them and see what other people were doing that was working. And it was in that relationship of reading, again, that I really saw what was so special about the form and why it's different than a novel. And my favorite thing about it, the thing that that aggravates readers of short fiction who prefer novels, is the very thing that I love about short fiction, which is there's a space in short stories for ambiguity and mystery, and there's a space for emotional discomfort that is not 100% resolved before the end of the story. And this is exactly the thing that is frustrating for some readers, which is, it ends too soon, or I don't feel like I get it. A lot of short story readers say, "Well, I liked the stories, but I feel like something was happening and it was out of my reach, and I didn't really get it when it ended." Or It was so sad. A lot of people say short stories are just so sad. And they leave you. The thing about good short fiction is that it leaves you with some sort of visceral reaction. My favorite short stories leave me with like a punch in the gut or a choke feeling in my throat or my heart is racing just at the end. Like just it builds you up to this place where you really get involved with the characters, really get involved with the narrative and the story and the emotions at hand. And then the story ends before it resolves it for you. And what I love about that is that it gives the problem to you. And when you close the book after you finish a story, you're left with all of that discomfort. And then you get to think about it. You get to figure it, not even answer it, but you get to just, you know, mull it over, like roll it over and roll it over and roll it over and think like, what does this mean? And what does that, and why do I feel like this? Why do I feel so unsettled? Because anytime you feel unsettled, you have this opportunity to sit with it and have a great think. Yeah. and that's what I'm addicted to. And that's what I'm addicted to, that great think. And, you know, there's a delicacy there when you're writing fiction. And I think that once you get a handle on being okay with leaving your readers with some kind of ambiguity, the danger, of course, is just building up and building up and building up and stopping and not having an artful way of giving just enough clues so that it's a gift of a think and not just a drop-off. Because a drop-off isn't that much fun. The drop-off, you kind of feel a little bit, you know, screwed over by your writer if there's a total drop-off. But if the writer gives you enough, that's yours. That's all your emotion that you get to deal with. And that's what I'm addicted to. That's what I love.
Now, I think you've put your finger on why I really loved studying short stories in university and why I'm not as much of a reader of them now, because when you have people to do that think with and talk it over with, and you get to sort of loll around in the story for longer than it takes you just to read it, then you can,
yes,
you have a bit of a structure for exploring.
That's
that
a really
mystery.
Really good point. I think that my structure for exploring the mystery is writing my own responses. I mean, because I'm a short story writer, when I read something that really punches me in the gut, I sit and think it, and then, you know, I don't just spin out. I have somewhere to go, which is back to the page, to a short story of my own that answers it but responds to it somehow. All of my stories are responses to other stories that I've read, either singly or in multiple. I do feel like it's this part of a greater conversation with other short story writers, you know, alive and not alive. And I do have a place to talk it over in my own short stories. And that is that every time I read a story that really kicks me out, I feel like I put it away somewhere. I squirreled away in the back of my mind. I'm like, I'm going to write to that next time. I'm going to do something with that.
Wow.
That's really interesting. I'm glad you said that, because I thought that's so true. That's so true.
I sort of have this theory that we have a natural creative process that ends up being just suited to the material and the genre that we're drawn to creating. And I'm kind of hearing some of that in what you're saying. Do you find that the methods of writing that you've come to, that you've discovered over the years, have married well with the short story, with what you love to write?
That's a really interesting question. Yes. I've always loved other forms of art, and there was actually a time where I never thought that my writing would be the main. There was a time where I thought, if I'm gonna have a job in the arts, it's not going to be writing. I guess because I just thought writing was separate, and that it's not. I never thought that it would be financially sustainable, and it's arguably not. So I went forward in another direction, but I still wanted to work in the arts. And I was painting. I was painting quite a lot, and I was selling them in galleries and in shows. And But my paintings all had they all had words on them, and it was like a vehicle really for little snippets of stories that were undeveloped or pieces that I hadn't done anything with. And I would paint a picture that had nothing to do whatsoever with the words. And I would then write the words on the bottom of them, and they created little stories only in the way that the story would actually exist just in the mind of the viewer, because the person would read this little piece of narrative, like, you know, there would be a character, like, I don't know, she wrapped the thing around itself until it finally caught, would be the words. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a picture of, I don't know, like a clothesline with a basket of apples underneath of it, and, you know, I don't know, something totally unrelated. So the person looking at the picture would make a story out of the clues that are there. And I did this for several years. I was working with these story paintings for several years, and eventually stopped because once it started to get once I started selling them and doing commissions for people, and once people started asking me more and more what they wanted stories about travel. They wanted more coherent stories. They didn't want the mystery. They wanted more, like, can you paint a picture of my cat and write, you know, I love my cat on the bottom of it. And I just sort of lost the joy and I stopped doing it. But there is something, I'm coming back, bringing this back home. There is something about the kernel, about what I was exploring in that form of art, that I have found much more restful and much more skillful in the form of just the simple short story. Actually, mm-hmm. It's image based. It has to do with clues and mystery, and it does give over a whole lot of the work of story making to the reader, which is really similar to what I was always doing, actually. So yes.
That's great. Wow, that's so interesting that. Did it end up feeling that the painting was a distraction from?
It ended up, it didn't. I think what more, unfortunately, I mean, I might go back to painting because I do miss it actually. But what happened was I was trying to pay the rent, selling these paintings, and then so they just became. In order to make them more marketable and to up my sales, I had to start painting them for someone else's pleasure instead of my own.
Right.
And I started painting and then I just created a job for myself. Like, I just created another job that I had to quit.
Yes.
it started out as this, like, very innovative, following my heart, following my passion, putting things that I love together and doing it myself. And then I just became a really hard boss, and I needed to take a vacation, but I was my own boss. So I ended up stopping painting. I'm sure that's a common story. I'm sure that happens to many people who follow their passion and then start doing it for the wrong reasons, or for economy, you know, for economic reasons rather than art. And art doesn't seem to listen to the economy in that linear fashion the way we'd like it to sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, that's a big that's a big area to talk about. You mentioned something in some of the material and story as a state of mind about how writing for publication sort of skewed your process for a little while there too.
Similar. It's the similar thing. Yeah. It's a really similar thing. And that was before I even had a book out. Like, that was when I was just trying to write what other people wanted. But now, you know, it's different having something that a publisher and reviewers and readers know and are familiar with and, you know, kind of expect from you.
Yeah.
It's really different second time around now. And I've heard writers talk about this before, and now I kind of see what it is. It's like, you really have to, it's like dance like no one's watching sort of thing. You have to really reconnect. It's not even a matter of pretending no one's watching. It's just really reconnect with what you're doing it for and take all the risks that you need to take, not only just to suck, like you have to risk suck, but you also have to risk doing something that no one's going to like.
Yeah.
And those are different. That's different. Like sucking to yourself and appearing to suck to other people are two very different things. And you have to risk both.
Oh, yes. you've talked a little bit about this already, but a big part of my work as a coach with writers and artists is on life design and helping people rejig their days and how they're supporting themselves and their commitments so that they have the space and time that they need for art. And so I'm hearing some of the ways that you've done that, but I also was reading that you try to separate your writing time from your teaching time even during the year and sometimes take retreats to really focus on something. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I'm coming to a point. I mean, it's all growing and it's all developing. And every time I complete a project, the rules seem to change and the stakes go up and the time all feels different. And I don't know if this has to do with, you know, getting older or just having being more in the public eye after the book has come out or what, but things just keep switching and changing on me. So I keep redefining my routine. It just never, you know, balance doesn't stop in one place. It just, I have to continually keep rebalancing. And since This Cake Is for the Party came out, and a lot of the shtick or the story that the media in Canada picked up on was that I was teaching and that I was teaching privately. And it was, you know, the television and radio, and they want to have something, they want a story about their people. So that was my story. So that was what was broadcast. And thankfully, delightfully from that, I got more and more calls about people wanting to work with me, more than I had earlier. So my previous state of balance of teaching and writing was, you know, I was always kind of looking for more work because there was never enough work, but I also had lots of time to write because I didn't have enough clients. And then it just sort of turned over where I had more and more people that I was working with, and they were really good and it was very exciting. And what I do, and you might know this being a coach, of course, also is put so much of my own energy into the work of other people. So there was a balance that I did reach, and then I tipped over a little bit where I was putting the energy that I was putting into my own revisions and my own writing and my own work was going into the work of my students. I mean, I would finish a day of writing and critiquing manuscripts and not want to look at my own, or not want to start, more accurately actually, I would not want to start writing something of my own because I'd already finished writing the book, so there was no more editing to be done. It was just, you got to start something new. And I would finish a day of working on manuscripts and feel like I'd just written all day. So how could I even go? I had no freshness to go back to my own work. So that was actually the seeds of Stories of State of Mind, because I love teaching and I love working with people, and I feel like the methods that I've developed I see how useful they are to my students, and I didn't want to stop. So I created something that would teach while I wasn't teaching, but that was still really authentic and real and not just a book so people, because I know that books on writing, nobody really, I mean, I read them, but I wanted something that really felt like you really were working with me as much as possible.
Yeah.
So that I could find, so I could rebalance, so I could find, so I could actually take a sabbatical that was a serious sabbatical, and get back in touch, just get back in touch with what it feels like for me to write now, which is different than what it was like to write 5 years ago. It feels different now. I want to write a new book, and I don't know what that is yet. So this is the start of my next sabbatical, which is a little bit more of a it's a little bit more serious, I'd say. I mean, I left Canada so I could find a little bit more focus, because I couldn't focus in Toronto anymore. I had to actually leave the city. And then when I went out to Whistler for a few months, I realized, oh, I have to actually leave the country. I'm still too accessible to go.
Where are you now?
I'm in Hawaii right now. Yes. And, on the north coast of Oahu, on the North Shore. And it's delightfully isolated. And it's, you know, 40 minutes from the nearest grocery store. And and so far, so good. But I still have wireless, so I don't know how this digital sabbatical is going to go.
Well, yeah, let's talk more about Story as a State of Mind, because it is, as you were saying, it's not just like a static book, like delivery of the material. It's an experience that you've built for people to go through at their own pace whenever they sign up, whether it's now or 2 months from now or whatever, to begin going through the lessons. And you have material on the craft of writing and techniques, and there are readings of short stories in there and audio lessons. It's really rich. I've just been exploring it for the last week. And one of the things that strikes me about it as a unique kind of program is it's kind of got this mix of high and lowbrow stuff going on. Like the fiction readings are, you know, the kinds of stories that you would find in lit magazines and that would, you know, be an award winning things. And the, you know, you're also teaching on some of the specifics of craft about dialogue and structure and that kind of thing. Mm. But then there's also, you know, there's the free writing piece coming in from your work with Natalie Goldberg, and just the fact also that it's delivered online, that it's this sort of new medium.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I have a specific question about this, but I'm just really interested in how you're pairing these two approaches, because it totally lands for me as somebody who also came through sort of the academic writing system and I have a real love for that genre and that world. But also, you know, here I am with my website talking about the more emotional, soulful side of writing. So
that's right.
There we go.
For some reason, and I don't exactly know what it is, I haven't talked enough about it with other writers in the academic literary world. There's just not even an opening really to talk about it. But for some reason, there's this, even though writers, if you ask them, where do your ideas come from, or how do you deal with the struggle of writing, or how do you do it when it's hard, or how do you deal with criticism, and all of these questions that bring up some serious emotional reactions and responses, even in the quote unquote serious writers, there's this resistance to even talking about it as I'm even stumbling over saying it, like it's as a spiritual process, as something that is soulful, as something that is reflective of the deeper life questions that human beings ask of themselves. And somehow, for some reason, in the literary world, you're kind of not really allowed to talk about that. And if you do, you're squirreled away into this other segment, which is either new agey or touchy-feely, or, you know, I'm rolling my eyes right now. You can't see me, but I'm I feel like that does writers a big disservice. And maybe it's just the academic system. Maybe in universities you're just not really, maybe it's not a safe place to go there. Maybe. I don't know. Or maybe it's not scientific, or I don't know what it is, but I felt going through the workshops and the schooling that I've done, that that was really missing. And I would supplement my study with reading books like Writing Down the Bones. I mean, Natalie Goldberg's book is just a classic. It's and it's about her meditation practice as well as her writing practice, and that makes sense to me, and it pulled me through a lot of the angst of trying to be good, not knowing if it's good or not, like the tremendous uncertainty of writing something, creating something, and then not even being able to really access ever if it's good or not, and not knowing, because reviews are so subjective, not knowing if there's ever any, you know, what is good and what is not good. I mean, this is just, these questions just could tear a writer apart if the writer is someone like me who stays up all night caring about these things. So I feel like there's a space for it. And I feel like it, when I started teaching my own classes and just sort of gently bringing some of my own coping methods, really, and not just coping methods, but also my celebratory, like my love and my passion and my love for the mystery that is the creative process into my classes, I just saw that my students, even the most hard-nosed, thinking, linear, smart students, really opened up when they were given permission to talk about the uncertainty and the fear and the energy that's behind all of the writing. It really helped to talk about it, and no one really does. I mean, even the very basic element of the writing exercise, where, you know, you write something, you free write, and you just write based on a prompt that someone else gives you, and you create a story out of that. I mean, that is kind of looked down on in certain writing programs. Like, no one talks about that. They feel like you should be over that somehow. Like, the writing exercise isn't serious enough, or it's just for people who don't know how to write yet or something, which I just think is ridiculous. I mean, how else are you going to learn how to write? How are you going to write something new if you don't exercise? I mean, everybody else exercises. Yes. So I had some frustrations and just realized, well, if no one else is putting this together, and it just seemed really obvious to me that it needed to be together. It needed to come to, like, it needed, if you just have the writing from your heart part of it, it will feel very good, but you won't necessarily have the structure in which you need to learn and grow. I mean, some learning technique and being really serious about learning technique is gratifying also to your soul, because every time you challenge yourself and get better and better and better and better, you're growing, and that's really good for you. So I didn't want to just make it a space of where everything is always good and okay. I mean, there's always room for improvement. So putting the two things together just really made sense to me. And I had the benefit of trying all of this stuff out on, you know, 10 years of my students who were delightful guinea pigs, as I just would try, like, what if I did? This works for me. I wonder if this will work for them. So, you know, why don't you take this piece of paper out and start doodling at the same time as you write? That's what I do, and it works for me. Why don't you try it? And it did, and it worked. It worked. So then I added that into the course. So Story of the State of Mind is sort of the result of everything that I did to for myself, and everything that I practiced on my students to make sure that it wasn't just because I was weird. there actually is something to it that no one's really talking about for whatever reason. And I just kind of stuck my neck out there, and it seems to be striking a chord. So I'm really grateful for that.
I would definitely say that I'm hearing that chord struck. So yeah, well, I want to say thank you to you for making the program. I mean, I know what it takes to build that from a technical and an emotional side.
Right.
And that's what I always say to writers too. Thank you for taking the time to do that and caring about the people that you're serving. And thank you for talking to me today about it. This has been a delightful conversation.
It's been great. Thank you, Allison, for inviting me.
I look forward to sharing more about the program. I'm hoping to do a review on my website.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And I will have links on my site to your website and to Stories of State of Mind if people want to check it out more. So thanks so much and have a great day.
Thank you. Have a great time in the program.